Thank you for choosing this track against those two, which are also interesting, and which for the second year I wish I visited, but it was the second year I'm presenting in parallel to other important topics. So, this talk will go over, I would say, a crisis of identity that we generally have when we need to interoperate. It's fine and good if you have all the identities in place and all the information associated with it, but usually you have to deal with some pre-existing systems and with the potentially bizarre ways how those systems handle their identities. And in some typical cases, you usually lack certain data that is important to your system rather than to that pre-existing one. So with this talk, I will try to tell how in FreeIPA we solved this problem recently, like in the last stable release, and how it went. So what is FreeIPA? I gave a talk on last year, and I'm borrowed a couple of slides from last year. And essentially, it's a suite of management tools that unifies what we have on Linux and overall in free software world to build up some system where you have secure storage of your credentials, your identities, and that extends not only to users or groups, but also to machines, to services running on those machines with semi-automatic or fully automatic management of those resources, like certificates, reissuing them over time before, for example, certificates expire, maintaining the coherency of the identities across multiple servers, and so on. We still don't have the A of IPA, but there's some light in the tunnel, not even in the end of the tunnel, but just in the tunnel, I guess, on the central login of the information and searching that data. And with FreeIPA representing itself kind of a server side of the solution, we have a sister project on the clients, which is SSSD, which provides all this information to the clients, caches data, enforces certain rules that we define as a policy, and overall saves our lives. And for the environments where you cannot run SSSD because it's not existing on a particular platform or the platform is not modern enough to compile the software, we have support for so-called legacy clients by representing parts of information that we can through the compatible LDAP schemas. Overall, it looks like this. So there's a core that runs different servers, the Kerberos KDC, the LDAP directory server, DocTag as a certification authority, a potential DNS server with a special plugin that is apparently high-performant enough to serve thousands, hundreds different zones in cached mode. NTP, which is quite important to keep the times in sync between different systems, and the management framework that allows to configure all this stuff and design how you would use it. And then on the managed host, which is a client, the prime component is the SSSD, which essentially replaces the PAM and NSS endpoints towards applications, but also provides pseudo rules management and enforcement of the access controls. And there's a lot of happening in the background. So for example, CertMongo on the client is the tool that rotates certificates and gives you a way to get out of headache if you have, let's say, thousands of hosts, each of them serving some HTTPS traffic. So the certificate for that host has to be valid, existing, and rotating in time, and so on. So for the purpose of what we consider here, we are basically caring about SSSD and caring about the directory server here. The picture that I showed is assuming that we are dealing with modern Linux systems. FreeIPA is available in Fedora, in various Red Hat Enterprise Linux-based systems. Recently, it went into Debian. I think it's in Seed, and there are multiple backports to Debian Jesse as well. There are certain functionality is not working in Debian due to long-standing issues with the crypto libraries like NSS versus the rest and OpenSSL. But the basic functionality works, and especially as a client, the systems like Ubuntu, Debian, and SUSE, they all can be clients to existing FreeIPA servers. And when you get to the actual customers that try to install and use it, there's most likely already exist an Active Directory deployment. And for that, we do support some mode where Active Directory domain controllers see us as Active Directory forest and assume that they can establish trust to us, and that actually happens, which is sort of miracle given the amount of work that you really need to get this done to be Active Directory forest. And the interesting part is that in order to provide your services, so services running in FreeIPA kind of domain for the users in Active Directory, you don't need to have a full-blown Active Directory at all. You need to have a minimal compatible implementation of the interfaces. And for 3 years already, we have this implemented and tested and deployed in multiple environments, multiple configurations. But one thing that works well in the direction from Active Directory to FreeIPA doesn't work in the other direction, meaning that IPA users cannot log in into Windows machines because we are missing some key components like global catalog so that Active Directory domain controllers can resolve those users when they come. And couple of other things, and we are really working towards seeing the Samba ADDC working with MIT Kerberos and then supporting Forest Trusts to get all this solved together. And finally have parts that are not dependent on Microsoft software to implement the infrastructure.
So you would actually implement a Samba 4DC inside FreeIPA to get that?
No. What we would implement is the global catalog compatible mode in FreeIPA that would be working with Active Directory domain controllers to do the resolution. Mm-hmm. But then the other part is to have the Samba ADDC working with all these things so that you can join Windows machines to Samba ADDC and keep the Linux machines on IPA side and yet have a full compatibility in this environment. We are not there yet, but we'll get there. And the features that I will be talking in this presentation, they are exactly for also covering the parts that are totally missing on the Active Directory side, or which require schema changes on the Active Directory side. So that kind of, that you don't need to do that. And this is also from the slide from last year, description of the trust work. Basically, this is how Samba is used within IPA to provide all this functionality. Now, when we get to the point that the Active Directory user comes to machine enrolled into IPA, the user gets recognized and identified, and it's the user's identity somehow mapped into POSIX attributes through the help of SSSD. We choose a particular design of operation here that the whole work on resolving happens only on IPA masters, so those machines that serve keep the directory server and KDC running and so on. And the clients, they don't need to know anything about the credentials for the situation when they need to talk to Active Directory, like the machine accounts and so on. This first, it allows us to reduce the scope of work and yet still get it working. And the second, it reduces the security exposure. Because right now, if, for example, you run WinBind on a member of a domain, not even kind of a server, but just machine joining to domain, any security breach on that machine makes the domain subject to possible attacks using the machine credentials of that machine. While when using the trust, if you get the IPA machine compromised, yes, you get some compromise against IPA, but this compromised machine cannot be used to mount attack against the trusted forest, Active Directory forest. And that seriously limits the security problems. And we hear a lot of questions from Windows admins. If this is Active Directory, then, hey, there's this set of potential attacks. How you kind of get against those attacks? So it also allows us to cache data on IPA masters when ID resolution happens, because most likely the resolution for groups specifically will be the same for multiple users. And we can cache them on the, at IPA masters and reuse when requests from different IPA clients are coming. And that in huge environments where you have like thousands, hundred thousands groups, that certainly allows you to reduce the network traffic, and logon time also drops considerably. But there are a couple of things that in the current implementation require us to use the two-way trust, because we rely on the cross-realm tickets on the Kerberos level to simplify the work. We are working on kind of getting around this by properly supporting a one-way trust in SSSD and using different identities for the trusted domain objects from the Active Directory side and so on. But also our current architecture that only IPA masters are really talking to the AD domain controllers and global catalog and so on, makes it possible that only IPA masters needs to be affected when this kind of change from two-way trust, one-way trust happens, or how it's implemented at all. Because clients, they don't care, they don't know about it. It also allows old clients to work with with, let's say, Active Directory, even though those clients never were designed to kind of understand Active Directory. And so we had some assumptions, and they are part of design in IPA. And some of those are pretty kind of standard. If we use LDAP, we store data in LDAP. So all the users that you see on a Linux machine, the centrally managed, they are entries in LDAP. So one entry contains all the POSIX attributes for that user or for that group. Then sudo rules stored centrally in the LDAP. This host-based access control is there. And public SSH keys for users and for hosts also stored in the LDAP and then fetched and provided for SSH server for verification. And then starting with IPA4, we have support for two-factor authentication using tokens, including hardware tokens, but also software tokens, and we have a companion application, free OTP, for Android and iOS environments, and I think there are a couple of experimental builds for some other devices that can really make a difference, like allowing you to not only disable the password-based logins into your, let's say, SSH, but also for, be it password-based Kerberos, obtaining Kerberos ticket, you have to always provide two parts of authentication to log in. And or refer external radio server, again, for hardware tokens that are kind of managed by some other party. And the result of it is that the Linux machines, yes, they have uniform view of all this data because SSSD provides them with this data. But they, for users, all machines have the same view on the POSIX attributes. So you have the same shell on all machines. You have the same home directory. You have the same kind of contexts. And so on. And because Active Directory users are not represented as objects in IPA LDAP, you cannot search simply and find it. So IPA LDAP is not a meta directory. It's not really something kind of proxying the data, which is sometimes a problem for certain applications, which expect that all users in the same LDAP server. And they work fine with Active Directory because they can be targeted towards global catalog to a certain degree, that especially true with the Java-based frameworks and web environments, but not really a kind of well working in this environment. And then you don't get per machine public SSH keys for users, which is big deal for some environments where you have, let's say, an account and different users have different SSH key for that account, so that different users can coerce in specific account. And yeah, we are progress certainly for the Linux machine management and overall ID management. But there are some anomalies. Migrating from other deployments sometimes becomes hard because this uniform approach gives you pretty harsh restriction. If you had file servers which were migrated even earlier from some, let's say, 20 years ago environment, and it has its own user IDs and group IDs for the users, totally separate from other environment, just because you use files on that machine and not anywhere else, then you cannot kind of get them working again. As soon as you retarget that machine against IPA LDAP, you get what? A uniform IDs, not the same as they were there, and the user ownership might simply break. Most likely it will break. And from the user experience point of view, having a different shell or a different path to the home directory is essential if you have those environments served by completely different operating systems. For example, if you have BSD systems, then most likely your default shell is not a bash or dash, but something like bin sha, and you want on IBM operating systems, you want probably KSH and something like that. And that's not existing. That you get either to select something that is absolute minimum existing on all systems, which is bin sha, and then change the shell once you logged into machine, or suffer. So we wanted to look at this problem and solve it so that people at least can set up their favorites. And public SSH keys, they are kind of important part for the environments popularized by GitHub or GitLab type of development, where you really have a single account and then differentiate by the public SSH keys for those users. And with the approach we selected, you could kind of assign for that user a group of SSH keys specific for that machine, kind of solving a problem. And yeah, there's a lot of scripts out there which are relying on the fields that are traditionally not used by anyone, like GCOS. GCOS is not something that people certainly use, but there are applications that do actually control decisions based on this field. 40 years of Unix were interesting, and some people did magic work at that time, like they thought. Then if you get the Active Directory users, you don't really have much freedom there, because either you store POSIX attributes at the Active Directory, which means you have to have a schema, you have to have some configuration which Microsoft officially announced is going to be retired, the GUI tools for it. Schema stays there, but managing it is not something that Microsoft willing to do, at least guessing from their public announcements. And then IPA provides kind of a templated way to name these users, to give them UID, GID, also shell and home directory. And because of public SSH keys, they are not something standard as LDAP schema and not existent in Windows world per se. By default, you need to extend schema again and manage those entries somehow. They don't have the public SSH key because there's no place to store them on Active Directory. And then if you migrate existing environments, you also get some issues, or rather not to say issues, but limitations again, that the users, in case of IPA, we had a solution that required to install a special synchronization plugin on the Windows side that synchronized users from Windows to IPA LDAP, and they were kind of normal Linux users in IPA, so you could assign certain attributes to them and so on. But this mode is not really compatible with the trust, because you are not supposed to have the same users in both directories. There's one primary source for those, let's say Active Directory, and you kind of separate them. And you have to get them somehow migrated. And if, again, they had UID, GID allocated for them, those identities most likely will be different from the ones that you get through the cross-forest trust. because of the way how they allocated. So we wanted to find a solution that allowed you to keep old data, old UID, GID in case you needed them, and yet still work with kind of modern environment. So we are progress, but we don't like to see this progress spinning down and burning just because of the all the decisions being wrong or some mistakes being made. And this rotation stuff here is hilarious. So it's like in 3 minutes it does 5 rotations and then, or did 5 rotations in 3 minutes across his own axis. Yeah, we certainly don't want our customers and our users to rotate like that. So we went and in pretty compact time frame did the thing that we call identity views. So identity views, it's a way to redefine POSIX attributes per system or group of systems or globally. And it's a container in IPA LDAP that contains sort of corrected POSIX attributes. Corrected to the term that you can put any data there. We are not verifying that, for example, UID, GID, they are strictly in the range that we kind of allocated for this domain. You can twist them back and forth. There are some limitations, of course, but they are here. You're fairly free to select certain things, and you can apply a set of these overrides to a host or group of hosts or several groups of hosts differently, so separately, and each entry is an override of original attributes. If you don't have an override, then the original stands. If there's nothing original, in the original there is no such attribute, then the default will be filled in. And defaults are, so for free IPA users, we already have the full featured LDAP objects that contain all this information. So the default identity view for IP users does not exist because it's the primary tree anyway. For Active Directory users and groups, there's one called specifically default trust view, and the client side actually verifies and applies the attributes from it. And they always apply and they are seen in all clients. So you don't need to really reconfigure anything. For the clients that already exist, if you want to apply these overrides to everyone. Now, one thing we don't have right now is templated definitions. Like if you want to have all users from Active Directory to have certain shell, we don't have that yet. That's certainly a valid use case, but not covered here. And here's the list of overrides. So for groups, it's fairly limited because the groups are themselves fairly limited in what they can have. You cannot override membership. So you cannot invent a new membership if you have a group. But you can override for the username. And that would kind of change a bit of membership, at least on the client side. And for the user, you can override pretty much everything that is existing. In the LDAP, this whole thing looks like the entry down here. This presentation will be available, so you will be able to look into the picture. Unfortunately, it's a bit smaller resolution than I wanted to see. Basically, if we have a user in Active Directory, it has certain attributes, and then those attributes can be overridden in the override entry. So here I have override for UID number and for login shell. And then on the SSSD side, in the cache entry for that user, we have both override and the original value. And depending on what mode of kind of applying these overrides is, we are either applying them or ignoring, depending on whether it applies to us or not. So they are applied on IPA master and a client depending on what we are doing. So host-specific views, they are applied on the client. The default views, they are applied on the master. It's not possible to have the host-specific view applied on the master because master has specific requirement to basically allow legacy clients compatibility, and that limits what you can do. So the logic is implemented in fairly new SSSD. Luckily, this SSSD has been backported to the older versions of Red Hat distributions, and I guess it will get into the CentOS 6.7 when RHEL 6.7 will be released too. And I think we even have this SSSD 1.12.2 in Fedora 20 updates so far. So it's pretty good coverage. And Ubuntu and Debian, they are tracking this as well. And the legacy clients are supported through a specific LDAP tree. We call it Compat tree. So when on the master, we apply overrides, they always apply the default one applied to the Active Directory. And the way how they apply it is something like in this scheme. So if I have some object like user A in Active Directory with POSIX attributes defined in Active Directory, and then I have some redefinition in default view for this user that defines that the UID number should be changed, but GID number should stay, then the result of applying them will be changing the UID number to the one that I kind of overruled. And this is on the server. And a client, if it doesn't really apply, for example, if it has a specific view, but nothing for this user in the view, then it gets the defaults from the server. This way, if you don't need to have some specialized thing, you don't do anything. It's just get applied on the server and serve it to everyone. This also a performance optimization, because if you don't need to apply anything on the client, you don't need to maintain complex caching and other operations. On the client itself, there's only this host-specific view is applied. And again, if we have some redefinition for now, this time is GID number in the view specific to the client, that GID number is redefined. But if you don't have anything, then the originals or defaults stand up. For the legacy clients, what happens is that there's a special so-called compat tree, which synthesizes records out of information we have on IPA master. The way it synthesizes, the defaults are applied always, so you kind of use compat tree on Solaris or AIX or something else, and they instantly see Active Directory users with these defaults applied. If you want to have something really specific to your host, you define a base DN to this kind of, instead of CN compat, you define it a bit longer for on the your software like PAM LDAP or NSS LDAP on the client, and it serves it, this specific view for this specific client. So the problem is that it's a work in progress, and certain features are not yet there. like the two-factor authentication is not yet supported for Active Directory users. The question is whether we want to support them, whether it makes sense to support them this way is open. Also given that there's some changes coming from Microsoft side towards how multi-factor authentication will be done by the Windows 10 clients onwards. So we are going to look into this. And the Radius server authentication also cannot be used for these users yet. But again, this depends on what makes sense and time to implement that sense. And before SSSD 112.2, the overrides, they only apply if you really logged in as that user on the machine. So then the user sees all the group membership changes that affected by the overrides. With 112.2, you get this even if user never logged onto machine. And yeah, the other part that we need to fix is removing host-specific ID view from the machine basically changes the ID allocation on that machine, which pretty much serious thing that might leak certain data, files owned by the users, which are not those users anymore from the perspective of UID, GID ownership. So you need to clean the cache and restart things, and we are going to reduce the amount of manual work that's done there. So there are some web pages and even documentation written, which is unusual to us. We usually have some sketch of the design and not the documentation, but this time there's even documentation how to use commands and so on. So I have a demo, and this was recorded for Red Hat Summit, which will happen next month. And after that, the demos will be on YouTube. But let's run them. So this is the example how you define through the web interface the actual overrides for the Active Directory user, and then see how they applied in a console window. We'll log in as an admin. Unfortunately, I don't know how to make it larger. And take a default view and then create new override. This time we are redefining, I think, administrator to have a different shell and different home directory on a machine. These demos, they are a couple minutes long. They go through all this stuff. So when we enter it and say add, the override is added. We can check that it's containing the values that we wanted to add here. So now on the actual machine, we can see that the original data for this user is not the one that we had in the override. Now, once we overridden it, we have different shell. There wasn't any shell before, and now there is different shell and different home directory. So, I apologize that it's not really visible from the distance, but there will be these demos will be available. And the another one is how to make an override of the public SSH key, which is probably not an override, how to add public SSH key associated with Active Directory users. So in this case, I just generate a key straight away here on a Windows machine, which also takes actually, I think, 5 times longer than the video shows. Randomness is missing everywhere. It's a virtual machine with the hardware random generator access, but still, SSH implementations don't give you any chance to miss something. So once we generated the key, we store it somewhere. I put actually a passphrase to this key. So this is not really a key that without a passphrase, so kind of easily used. Then I stored it so that I can load it into the interface. Actually, what I stored here is this private part of the key. Now I just copy the public part of the key. Okay. And go to the web interface. The same commands available over the console. So this can be scripted, for example, if there is available data. And for existing this admin user, I just add the SSH key. Let's see. Go into ID views, default trust view. We have administrator here, and we add SSH key. So just paste the public key. Save it, here's the public key, and it's immediately accessible on the server. Now I can log in using, in this case, PuTTY to the server using normal kind of way of specifying parameters in PuTTY. In this case, I specify my private SSH key and specify my username. Yes, a long one. And it logged in as that user, and it has this group membership also amended by the default view, because I changed some parameters in it when I set it up. Yeah, so daemons will be available. These slides are available already at this address. It can be downloaded. And I hope they will also be available from the sambaxp.org.
I just have a small comment. You mentioned that if you change the client-specific view, you have to make sure the cache is deleted and SSD restarted. So we improved this already a bit, so you only need to restart SSD. SSD can detect if the view has changed, and if it changed, it will delete the components of the cache.
Yes, but this is not released yet.
Maybe not in RHEL. Yeah.
Not at Fedora.
Yeah. But we decided that we won't do any further automation. So you have to restart SSD. Yeah. So kind of manual action that you are aware that your IDs might change.
Situation is exactly the same as changing the data provider in SSD for any other case. So for example, if you had Active Directory provider configured, ID provider, and then you're changing for a normal LDAP and retargeting against completely different server, then your identities might likely change as well. So you have to restart SSSD to apply those changes. And changing the applicable view is essentially the same. It's a serious operation that changes identity of users and processes that they run under. And if we address them by name and UID change it, then the process that runs under older UID is not that under that user anymore. So it's really important to kind of choose your step where you yeah. Okay, Matthew, you wanted?
No, you are stretching.
Okay.
Just a comment to make it maybe more clear. You mentioned that the views are available for legacy client, and what it means is that the server applies these views and makes a full LDAP tree with these views applied available to legacy clients. So if you have legacy clients with all their PAM LDAP or NSS LDAP components, you can point them a specific subtree on the server and you get a different view as defined.
Yeah, the view, the subtree stays stable from the perspective of that old client. And it's just that the DNs will be different for users if they are looking at different subtrees, but within the same server, they have the same kind of subtree. And what's more important is that any authentication, like LDAP bind as that user, will still work, regardless which view is that and which override is there. So if you overrode administrator as foobar, then your LDAP bind will need to use foobar as the name of that user. So it's consistent in this way.
But the password will be that of the administrator?
Yes.
So the password will stay consistent. The user is still that one.
Passwords are not overridden.
Not yet.
Not yet. I don't know whether this would be a feature or not. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.